Welcome to the Continuous Delivery Podcast. My name is Zarar.
And I'm Gino.
It's been a long time. And I think the last time we did this podcast, we promised that we would do it weekly, but we are promise breakers. But let's make today's count.
Rebels.
And I know, Gino, that you got a topic brewing there, which in the pre-talk, I was like, really? That's a continuous delivery topic? But why don't you explain yourself and then we can get into it.
Well, it is and it isn't, right? So it is not continuous delivery when you're looking at it from a technical perspective. We all think, when we're talking about continuous delivery, we all think about coding. We all think about putting something in a source code management system that automatically goes into production. You can get feedback from it and so forth. That's what we think about when we are applying continuous delivery. I'm working with a client right now where continuous delivery is kind of interpreted differently. But I was wondering about this. I said, like, is this just one of those cases where continuous delivery is just used for something else just to sound sexy or to be, in line with everything that is going on in the industry? Or are there really principles that are sitting underneath it that we can apply in this particular environment? So let me explain what the environment is. The environment is an organization that is responsible for maintaining hundreds of applications for their business. Those applications are all services. There's a little bit of development necessary, sometimes integrating with the current ecosystem. But most of it is really configuring something on one of those SaaS services, or another thing might be making a report available. So really dealing with customer requests. So that's essentially the environment, which is, as I said, from a technical perspective, not continuous delivery at all. But I would argue that what they're trying to achieve is continuous delivery from a principle perspective. Now, of course, it's unfortunate that Cheesy is not on this call because he would immediately refute that. But this is kind of the topic of today. So, Zara, what are you thinking about this?
I mean, as soon as you were talking, I mean, my mind went to configuration management.
Right.
Kind of like if you have these, I'm not saying you're doing this, but I mean, Salesforce is a great example, which is one of those applications where it's like, you know, maybe 60% configuration, 40% development, or any of these CRMs, which are really high on configuration. And then the question becomes, well, how do you make sure to test or take this configuration change to production? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't lend itself necessarily nicely to, you know, commit, push, deploy, run tests, validate change, get feedback. But there is an element of some principles we can use. And the one that pops into mind is certainly automatic configuration management and validation of the change you made in a more real-time way. Because usually you make a configuration change and then you ask your QA team to test the 500 lines in the Excel file that they have accumulated over a decade. So I'd say, part my mind went to configuration management, part went to change testing. Deployment, that's going to be a tricky one with these systems. But yeah, I think the two principles is definitely making small changes that are testable,
right,
and then pushing that change safely into your prod environment.
Safely and as fast as you can, so you get that feedback, right? Which is really what now allows you to make those business decisions, which what I think in essence is what continuous delivery is about. There's a couple more things I find. So you talked about the deployment aspect of it. You could set up, I'm telling you at my client, that's not currently the case, but you can set up a deployment in a way that you're making this configuration change as you're correct. A lot of those things are configuration changes, that you're making those configuration changes on the staging environment and that overnight you're actually switching those, right? So you have a blue-green deployment or you're automatically promoting it to a production environment. That might be another way of dealing with it. So those things are definitely possible. Those would be techniques that are completely transferable from a standard continuous delivery approach. But the real things why I'm talking about it and that I consider, well, you know what? Maybe continuous delivery is not such a bad name. Is because what you're really trying to achieve is you're really trying to disconnect release from deployment again as well. You're really trying to ensure that you are focusing on the value and the outcome, and you trying to figure out how you can give basically the autonomy to the team so that they understand, if they understand the outcome really well, that they have some autonomy and they have some understanding of what are they can potentially do to deliver that value to ensure that the needle moves. So it's those kinds of things that I'm talking about. So organizations can work with OKRs. They communicate those OKRs or negotiate them with the teams. The teams take those and say like, okay, hang on, what is in our power? What can we do in order to actually contribute to those key results and so forth? Of course, there is also the autonomy and making sure that everyone on the team can make those changes. There is the testing that you're referring to. And I'm happy to see that some of the investments indeed go to making sure that these configuration changes can automatically be tested. And that that they're building up automated test suites that that can be run. It's not quite in a pipeline as what you would expect in a continuous delivery environment, but the APIs, they can be tested that way. The integrations with the backend systems, with some of them can be tested that way. So there's elements of continuous delivery that definitely are transferable to those environments. And essentially, they're driven by the same need and the need for getting fast feedback, for making sure that you are making your deployment as less risky as you possibly can, or to reduce that risk as you're going through it by making the changes small, but making sure that you have autonomy and people can actually make the changes and the decisions where the knowledge sits. All of those things for me are still principles that they have in common with continuous delivery. And as a result, I wouldn't say it's such a bad name at all.
Yeah, I think the isolation aspect, sometimes we run into trouble with that whenever you're dealing with some of these systems that you have to configure. Because if you have a, let's say a CRM system and you want to make a config change to it, I think one problem you run into is that whereas in a software application, deployments and artifact creation is relatively cheap, and it's very easy to say, like, let's say you're running a Spring Boot server and you make a change, it's very easy to fire up a VM and deploy a version of the service. Mm-hmm. I think I've talked about Vercel in the past, which is, I think, one of my, I know people like to crap on it on Hacker News and all that, but Vercel is to me a gold standard example of how you can isolate front-end changes and sort of test them safely, because you can spin up a VM, you can spin up a front-end, deploy it, and you can test the commit, basically.
Yeah.
The same is very difficult in these sort of big hairy applications. And I necessarily haven't found a solution to that, because they're also expensive to spin up. Even if you had the ability to actually fire up a new Salesforce instance or fire up a new, whatever, there's a licensing cost that hits you right away. So the business model comes in the way of continuous delivery there, because yep. even though you did all the right things, you made the small change, you isolated it, your software is in a deployable state. Well, now you run into kind of organizational costs. And like, if you work in a company like Amazon, which does cloud hosting, or one of these big tech firms, these are not that big of a concern, because these costs are relatively cheap there. But for somebody who's using these services,
yep.
it quickly mounts up. And I think what happens then is you start batching changes, right? Because the cost of a change is high, you start batching it. So the batching of changes and the cost is where the sort of falls apart.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if... So your entire argument makes an awful lot of sense, but I'm not quite sure if that's a valid argument for batching changes, though. It's true that it's sometimes difficult to have multiple environments because of licensing costs and so on, but batching changes is not going to make that different. What is a possible strategy, though, and I think we both have seen at the same client that we both worked at the time, and I'm not quite sure if you were exposed to that particular thing, but there are frameworks that make it very difficult to implement something like a feature toggle. Yet, with a little bit of creativity and so forth, you can build that into most of those systems. Does it take extra work? Yeah, of course it does. But you do it once, you invest in the technology, if you will, and you can reuse it for further deployment. And in that way, you can still make those changes in an environment in a way that is more isolated, if you will, and still in an environment that is immediately into production without necessarily having this licensing cost. The situation that you oftentimes have as well is that development instances do not come at the same cost as production instances. And as a result, you can work a little bit with that as well. So there's multiple avenues that you can consider to reduce that cost and still have availability to at least two environments. But you're absolutely right. You can't just automatically spin up yet another environment. It typically is a full blown environment that is installed twice and that you have access to. And those are the environments that you need to work with. Having a third and a fourth and a 16th is going to be incredibly hard.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned toggles there, and I think toggles work really well if you are actually deploying quite frequently. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, in big companies, the deployment frequency is fairly low. Mm-hmm. And even though you're putting stuff behind a feature toggle, when you do turn the toggle on, a whole bunch of functionality suddenly goes live. Right. So that sort of defeats the purpose of a feature toggle in some way. But when that happens, I have found another tool that I've discovered recently, Posthog, which is, again, just blows me away, the amount of smart people in this world working on cool stuff. But we can get into that in a different episode. It's just the idea of like, it's kind of like scaling your change to a smaller population first, like a canary or something mm-hmm. like that. Even if you're in a big company, you can, I think your business case or your implementation for this should sell the idea that even though your deployment frequency is still low and you may have barriers to increase that, which are valid. And, you know, let's not, you know, I'm not going to argue that maybe they are valid, but you can still take advantage of canaries to actually kind of like peek into production and see what's going on. I think especially if you do population control, if instead of feature toggles, you're also able to layer in some sort of population control, I think the executives now see the benefits of this much more clearly than just the toggle.
So when I was talking about feature toggles, I'm not talking about an on or off for everyone, right? That's what you're referring to is exactly what I'm talking about. That you can control who sees the feature and who does not, and that you can open up the gates, if you will, bit by bit, so more and more people get through it. More and more people can start using that feature. That's what I'm referring to. So the risk really of turning all those features on should be limited because it's tested with that initial population already, whether it's a single team, whether it's a set of people with a specific role, whether it's one person of every role, right? Whether it's your own team, whatever it is that you're using to ensure that the features and the functionality is at least being used, and that that you basically know that it works, that there's no hiccups, and only then you start slowly opening it up. So that's when I'm talking about feature toggles, I'm not talking about the big. I'm not talking about either having electricity in your whole home or having none at all, right? I'm talking about turning off a switch so that potentially you can't turn on the lights in your living room, right?
But it always, whenever you're dealing with like a third-party app, it always comes down to the testability of that application.
It does, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And whereas in a kind of greenfield, homegrown, you know, regular kind of, you know, Jamstack or whatever application, you can fairly isolate the change and test it. In these big systems, you're usually just testing through the UI mostly.
I mean, sure, but there's some APIs there too, though. There must be. There is some traffic under the hood. There is some network traffic that you could possibly spoof and actually understand what needs to go on there. Of course, it all takes extra effort, right? Don't get me wrong, but the effort might be worth it.
So it's not just about the point I was trying to make is that. Regardless of if it's the UI or an API you're testing, mocking is very difficult. Mocking of the data is downright, you know, it's costly. And I think whenever people kind of like go on this endeavor where they're trying to apply continuous delivery principles, like, you know, small fast testing and all that to like these applications, the test data just becomes a big, big problem, because now you have to kind of dig into the internals of the system to reroute things. And the only way that I have seen this happen is when you sort of like stand up a separate instance and you reroute like DNS traffic pretty much. So instead of the system calling its database, it's calling a mock data. But those are very expensive, not just to set up, but you really need a very strong test data management strategy. And unfortunately, the QE quality engineering departments, they're mostly still kind of playing checkers when they need to play chess. Instead of just talking about, you know, enterprise automatic test data management and solving these problems, we're still sort of figuring out, well, I'm just testing the test cases with the UI. And that to me is a problem yet to be solved completely.
Test data is definitely a difficult issue, but that is true for other systems as well, where it's difficult to get under the hood. There's other strategies too, though, that might work for you. It kind of depends on where you're at. And those strategies might be to set up, let's say you're working in an organization and there is a system that takes care of administration for different departments. You might be setting up a department that is representative of the rest of your organization that is not included in most of the reporting, unless you have a certain toggle on or whatever that might be. And that's then taking care of that being included in the reporting. So that's kind of a way of doing it. Is it entirely the same? No, it's not. Because of course, when you draw a report, you're including this additional data, or you're excluding the data that is actually the production data that you can't control because you don't know what's in it. And as a result, you can't automatically test your report. So it's those kinds of things though. But there is a little bit that you can do. And then you need to kind of bridge the gaps with end-to-end testing, if you will, with some manual verification. But the majority of the tests, you could still, though, automatically run and still get benefits from that. Well, you know, there are creative ideas to get through this. Don't get me wrong. It takes extra effort. Again, the challenges are definitely require more creative thinking than when you have everything, a control over everything, and everything is decomposed in the way that you want it to. But there are ways to do it if it's painful enough to that make sense if it's painful enough to make those changes and get confidence that the changes that you're making are actually working in production.
Well, I mean, I'd say, you know, we would talk about shift left. I think this might be an example of like shift right, where and Stripe is a good example of this one, is where you have your test data isolated in production. Mm-hmm. If you're a Stripe developer, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, you log into the Stripe console and there's a big button at the top which says, you know, test mode. And test mode is basically data isolated in production entirely for test purposes. And I think I one time I read their engineering blog, and they were talking about how really the differentiator is the account ID. Basically, you have like, if you look at their relational database schema, it all comes down to whether something is test or not, comes down to there's this one table which specifies whether this API key is a test, is test or dev. So, but again, that kind of goes back to my previous point, is that those things are possible, but they require some strategic thinking from your quality engineering, from your developers, from your organization. Totally agree, totally possible, but who is thinking that way? I don't know many companies who take the approach that Stripe has taken, and they process, you know, millions and millions of transactions across hundreds of geographies, tons of regulation. So don't, you know, the answer that we're regulated or we're, you know, it's our, you know, it that just doesn't hold, because you have this counterexample just thrown at your face, and it really makes you wonder, like it makes you think, challenge you first of all, that if they can do it, why can't you? And it's not because of lack of talent. I think it's because of a lack of strategy.
Not necessarily a lack of strategy, but I do agree, though. Who is doing it? A lot of organizations, I think, just don't know. They're just ignorant to those particular things, which is why this podcast is valuable, Zarar. This is why we're doing this, to expose these particular techniques to people who otherwise might not hear from them. And this is why you're in the job that you are, and I am in the job that I'm in. that is to expose people to these particular techniques, to help them think creatively, to help them overcome their problems in ways that they might not consider, that they might not see as feasible. It's the can-do attitude that that gets us over those humps. And you and I both, and the colleagues that we're working with and that we value it in the same way, we are all encountering situations that we never have encountered before. Yet, we know that there are better ways of doing it. And sometimes it takes us a while to find a creative solution that makes sense. Sometimes it rolls off our sleeve. And sometimes by just mentioning what is possible, somebody else on the team comes up with an idea that none of us could have thought of. So it's really exposing people to that mindset of, hey, there must be better ways of doing it. This is how they do it in this particular environment. What would be possible in your environment to get something similar or at least similar benefits?
And so, I'd say you don't need, and going back to like that old famous Steve Jobs quote, I don't think you need expensive external consultants to come up with these ideas. Yeah. This knowledge, these ideas are already in your org. The question is, have you created the space in your org to hear them? If you treat your employees as a hierarchical structure and there's a very, you know, chain of command and people can only talk to their directs, you're basically, the side effect of that organizational structure is that you're stifling these ideas. And I think if you're a manager or somebody listening to it, I'd advise you to, the key to success here, the key to discovery here is may not come from outside. You already have it. And I think that's where the power of Agile really comes, is when you are actually able to get the people you currently have working in a different way so that these ideas bubble up and you're not stuck in gridlock.
Unlock their potential. Amen. Yeah. I think we should finish this. This is a wonderful note to finish on, don't you think, Sarar?
I think so, too. It's 22 minutes. We won't make any promises this time. We're going to record next. But we'll try to do it soon enough. Listener, thank you. Follow us on our LinkedIn group. And we also have a Twitter account called Continuous Pod. Although Twitter is dying, so I'm not even sure that it's a good idea to do it. Well, just follow us on LinkedIn, the Continuous Delivery Podcast. My name is Hino. My name is Zarar. Thank you.
And I'm Hino. Yeah.
And see you all soon enough. Goodbye.
Take care.